for him. And they would walk to the trattoria and have a gelato or play a game of checkers in the piazza in his hour of free time. Padre Sebastiano, the director of the seminary, was indulgent with Angelo, giving him certain allowances due to his circumstances and regular donations from Camillo. Fabia would crochet, Angelo and Eva would talk and laugh, and Angelo would be fortified until they came again. Slowly but surely, Angelo shed his little boy lost persona and became a true Italian seminarian, blending in with all the other boys who attended school with the goal of becoming Catholic priests. But when he turned 15, Angelo told Eva to stop waiting outside for him. He said it was frowned upon and the other boys teased him. Eva had laughed and said, "But we are family." He had looked at her then, his mouth pursed, like he wanted to say something. He had waited until Fabia's attention was elsewhere. "What, Angelo?" Eva huffed, her hands on her hips.
"You and I are not related, Eva."
"But we are family, Angelo." She was hurt by his rejection, but he was unyielding, the way only Angelo could be.
"You are too beautiful, and I am too attached to you. And you are not my sister or my cousin or anything close."
He repeated firmly, almost as if the truth of it made him sad.
"The other boys think you are beautiful, too. And they like to say things about you and me. So I need you to stop coming here."
Things had changed between them after that. Eva stopped waiting outside the gate for him. And even though the seminary was only 5 blocks away from the villa they both called home, she only saw him on school holidays or on the weekends when he missed his grandparents. They still talked and laughed when they were together, and she still played the violin for him. But things had definitely changed. She needed him now, though. She needed to talk to him, to tell him her world was falling apart. Their world. For their worlds were intertwined by their families, whether Angelo wanted to claim her or not. She walked down the street, finding herself looking at the familiar buildings and people of her neighborhood through new eyes. No one acted any differently. No one stared at her or pointed a finger at her, yelling, "Ebrea! Jew!" Donna Mirabelli was walking toward her on the street, and when she saw Eva, she smiled warmly, greeting her the way she always did. The shops were open. The earth had not opened up and swallowed Italy whole. The laws were silly, Eva told herself. Nothing would change. This time, Eva didn't wait at the gates for Angelo to appear. She walked across the piazza, past the fountain where John the Baptist stood in the center, his arms outstretched and surrounded by doves, and let herself in through the entrance with the neat little placard announcing to visitors that they had arrived at the Seminario di San Giovanni Battista. John the Baptist was the patron saint of Florence, and everything was named San Giovanni something or other. The door opened into a small foyer, where a tired-looking priest with thinning hair was typing away at a little desk. A few students traversed the wide staircase beyond him. They stopped in their tracks when they saw her. Apparently, female visitors were unusual. The typing ceased, and the priest looked up at Eva expectantly, removing his glasses.
"I need to see Angelo Bianco. Please. It is a family matter."
"Wait here, signorina," he said politely,
setting his spectacles down and smoothing his cassock as he stood. He walked swiftly to the double doors to his left, and Eva wondered if there was another set of stairs or if Angelo was just beyond the doors. When Angelo appeared, his forehead creased with concern, his blue eyes wide, his hands outstretched toward her, he already had priestly mannerisms. Eva did her best to smile and put him at ease, though she wanted to throw herself at him. His hair was parted neatly and slicked down, tamed but not smooth. It rippled like the surface of the sea on a breezy night, dark and glossy. She fought the urge to run her fingers through it, freeing the curls. She gripped his hands instead and found herself fighting off tears.
"Can you walk with me?"
she asked in a rush.
"Eva, what is it? Tell me what's wrong. What's happened?"
"Everyone is fine. It's not anything like that. I... just please, Sir Angelo. I need to speak with you."
"Give me a moment."
Angelo acquiesced and turned, walking as swiftly as his limp would allow. He was back a few minutes later with the wide-brimmed black hat, typical of seminarians, and the cane he had stopped resisting.
"Can you just leave with me?"
She felt like she was going to be detained at any moment.
"I am 21 years old, Eva, and I am not a prisoner. I've told Padre Sebastiano that I am needed at home and will be back in the morning."
They walked across the piazza and out into the street. But Eva didn't want to go home. Not yet.
"Can we walk for a bit? I've spent all day listening to Fabia's tears, my father's strategizing, and Santino's hammering. Why does he always find something to hammer when he's upset? Uncle Felix has been playing the violin all day, terrible, terrible songs. And when he's not, he's pacing."
"The laws."
Angelo didn't ask. He already knew.
"Yes, the laws. I can't go to school now, Angelo. Did you know that? I should have enrolled last summer, like my father told me to do. They are letting Jews already enrolled in the universities continue with their studies. But I wasn't enrolled. No, I can't. No new Jewish entrance allowed."
"Madonna,"
Angelo breathed, the words sounding like a curse instead of a plea. They walked in silence, both of them lost in helpless fury.
"What will you do instead of school?"
he asked finally.
"I wanted to teach music, but there will be many Jewish teachers looking for work now that they can't teach at the regular schools."
"You could teach private lessons?"
"Only to Jewish students."
"Well, that's something. Isn't it?"
He tried to smile encouragingly. Eva frowned back at him.
"Maybe I will marry a nice Jewish boy and have fat Jewish babies and live in the ghetto. And maybe we will be run out of our country like the Schreibers were run out of Germany. Like my grandfather Adler is being run out of Austria. Like Uncle Felix is being run out of Italy."
"What are you talking about? Who are the Schreibers?"
Angelo tipped his head in question.
"The Schreibers, remember, the German Jews who came to stay with us."
Eva couldn't believe he'd forgotten. When Adolf Hitler became Chancellor of Germany in 1933, things started to go very badly for Germany's Jews. Laws had been passed, just like the laws being passed in Italy. Eva stopped walking, her stomach churning. They had thought it couldn't happen in Italy. But they were just like the Schreibers. They were just like all the refugees that Camillo had opened his home to. For 2 years they had had people in the guest house. Different families. All Jews. All Germans. And none of them stayed long. The Rosselli Villa was a place to regroup before permanent plans could be made. All the refugees were quiet, and they kept to their rooms. The Schreibers had a daughter who was Eva's age and one a little older, Elsa and Gita. Eva thought they could all be friends. She spoke German. But the German girls never came out of the guest house. Eva complained in the beginning that they might as well not have guests at all. To her, having guests meant entertainment, fun. Camillo explained that the refugees were tired and afraid, and none of this was fun for them.
"Afraid of what? They are in Italy now."
Italy was safe. Italians didn't care if someone was Jewish.
"They have lost their homes, their businesses, their friends, their whole lives. Mr. Schreiber isn't even Jewish."
"So why did he have to leave?"
"Because Mrs. Schreiber is."
"She is Austrian,"
Eva retorted, so sure of herself.
She is an Austrian Jew. Just like Mama was. Just like Uncle Felix is. It is illegal under the new laws in Germany for a German to be married to a Jew. Mr. Schreiber was going to be sent to prison, even though he was married to Annika long before the laws were passed. So, they had to leave.
The Schreibers were the first. But there had been many more. A steady stream, actually.
Some were more open than others, relating horrors that seemed impossible.
Uncle Augusto had even scoffed at some of the stories. Privately, of course, and only in conversation with Camillo, who grew increasingly gray during those 2 years. What couldn't be denied was that most of the refugees they took in, even if for only a short time, seemed to be in varying states of shock, and there was an ever-present nagging tension among them, as if at any moment the local authorities would swoop in and arrest them.
"I don't remember them, Eva," Angelo said softly. "But I do remember their being strangers for a while."
"For 2 years, Angelo. Then they just stopped coming. Babo said they couldn't get out of Germany anymore."
Eva hadn't really understood what that meant. She had just shrugged and life went on. There were no more skittish Jews at the villa. Until now. Now their villa was full of skittish Jews. Eva clenched her fists and stopped walking, needing every ounce of strength to keep her tears behind her lids. But they seeped out the corners and dribbled down the sides of her face. She turned and blindly walked the other direction, looking for some place to let them fall without an audience. Angelo followed, a silent shadow, his slightly uneven gait oddly soothing. Eva walked without realizing that she'd known her destination all along.
She found herself just outside the San Frediano gate on Viale Lodovico Ariosto,
standing at the entrance to the old Jewish cemetery. Her mother wasn't buried there. Her Rosselli grandparents weren't buried there either. The old cemetery had closed in 1880, almost 60 years ago, long before they died. The tall cypress trees that lined the path leading from the entrance made her feel safe.
They always had. Her father had brought her there once long ago and showed her where his maternal great-grandparents were buried. They were Nathans, and he was proud of the name. He said Nathan was a Jewish name with an impressive history. Sadly, Eva didn't remember it. But she loved the cemetery and had come back alone many times, setting her smooth stones on those Nathan headstones, vowing each time to ask Camillo more about her ancestors. But she never did. Very few stones decorated these headstones now. 60 years was a long time to carry memories and leave pebbles in their place. She had no stones with her today. No pebbles or pretty rocks. No weight in her pockets and far too much heaviness in her heart. The time-worn headstones reminded her of a mismatched chess set. Some stones were fat and curved, others tall and ornate, but most were short and tottering like ancient pawns. Eva liked to imagine the shape of the markers was a caricature of the person buried there, and she took pride in the royal stature of her ancestors' monuments. She wove her way to the far corner, to the little bench that someone had erected long ago to sit with long-dead loved ones. Angelo followed, still silent, but he'd pulled off his hat, as if wearing it among the graves was sacrilegious. It was ironic, she thought. Jewish men covered their heads, signifying themselves beneath God for prayer and religious rituals. But she didn't tell Angelo.
"What is this place, Eva?"
he asked, sitting beside her carefully, his hands in his lap, his hat in his hands, his cane leaning on the bench between them. Eva fought the urge to knock it down. She was tired of things that came between them.
"It's an old Jewish cemetery."
She kicked at the blanket of fallen leaves and untended grass at her feet and upended a little rock. Leaning down, she retrieved it, brushed the dirt from its surface, and shined it between her palms. Then she stood and placed it on the base of the oldest Nathan headstone and sat back down next to Angelo. He reached for her hand and turned it over so he could see her palm. "Why did you do that?" Angelo took out his handkerchief and started gently removing the grime from her hands. His tenderness wiped away her anger, too. Ava's lips trembled, and she wanted to lay her head against his shoulder and cry out all her fear and confusion.
"Ava?"
he prodded softly when her answer never came. She swallowed back the feelings in her throat and tried to speak. Her voice was low, barely a whisper, when she finally responded.
"The story Babo told me is that in ancient times, it wasn't common to mark graves with a headstone or any kind of marker. Jews did it. But they did it to avoid inadvertently stepping or bending over a grave and desecrating it or becoming impure from the body beneath the ground. I don't know exactly. It's a mitzvah."
Ava shrugged, a uniquely Italian shrug that said, "I don't know, but knowing isn't very important."
"What's a mitzvah?"
"Something, a holy act or tradition that elevates the mundane to the divine."
Again the shrug.
"So before the days of headstones and markers, every person who walked by the grave added a rock, building it up so the monument became permanent. I guess, eventually, someone thought of adding a bigger rock with a name or birth date, so people would know who was buried there. And now, we do it as a sign of remembrance."
"Something that elevates the mundane to the divine," Angelo murmured. "That's beautiful."
He was done with her hands, and he gently returned them to her lap, ever respectful, ever careful. Ava didn't want her hands back. She needed Angelo to hold them tightly, to grip them in his and tell her everything was going to be all right. The emotion swelled again, and her thoughts were so loud, so insistent that she pressed a trembling hand to her forehead so they wouldn't escape. But the devastation of the day had peeled back her defenses, and she found herself blurting out all the things she shouldn't say.
"I thought I would marry you someday, Angelo. Do you know that? I wanted to marry you. But that can't happen now, can it?"
He gasped, but didn't answer. She finally made herself look at him, and his blue eyes clung to hers. There was awareness there. Her words shocked him, but her feelings didn't.
"That was never going to happen, Ava. In 1 year, I will be able to receive the holy orders, and I will become a priest."
"I am going to be a priest, Ava. My path is set," he said firmly.
But there was tension in the set of his lips, and the hand he raised to her cheek shook slightly. She pulled away in disgust, brushing at his hand like he was a persistent fly. Her feelings kept bouncing back and forth between tenderness and outrage.
"No, it can't happen because I am a Jew, and it's now against the law for Catholics to marry Jews. It's against the law for me to love you, Angelo. It should make it so much easier for you now."
"What are you talking about, Ava?"
Angelo kept his voice neutral, soft, like he was trying to calm a fretful child. But she wasn't a child, as Angelo was well aware.
"I've seen the way you look at me, Angelo. You want to be a priest, but you love me."
"Ava."
The word was like a whip, and Ava flinched.
"You can't say things like that."
He stood abruptly, his cane gripped in his hands.
"We have to go. It will be dark soon, and after a day like today, your father will wonder where you've gone."
Ava stood, but she wasn't finished.
Babo says so many boys become priests because of family pressures. Because they can get an education they may otherwise not get. He worried that you were forced into the seminary because your father and your grandparents wanted you to go, and because you never felt like you had a home.
It wasn't like that for me, Ava. You know that. You know being a priest is what I want.
But you were a child.
Her voice was hesitant.
How could you have known what it would cost?
It has cost me very little compared to what it has given me.
His eyes were so clear, so guileless, yet so fierce, that it was all she could do to hold his gaze.
God makes me strong. He gives me courage. He gives me peace. He gives me purpose.
His voice was filled with conviction.
And he can't give you those things unless you're a priest?
Ava asked sadly.
No. No, Ava. I don't think he can. Not in the same way.
He held out his arm, a peace offering, and Ava slipped her hand through it, letting him lead her out of the cemetery. They picked their way among the graves, and Ava was suddenly glad for his arm. Her anger and despair had boiled over and left her cold and weak, tired. She numbly placed one foot in front of the other until Angelo spoke again.
I would have been a soldier, a pilot. If I'd been born with two good legs, I would have been a pilot. I've dreamed of flying since I could walk. Maybe it's because I couldn't run like the other boys. You don't need to run if you can fly. Now, with war in the air and Mussolini passing these insane laws, I'm grateful for my bad leg. I'm grateful I won't have to drop bombs and fight for things I don't believe in.
Is the Catholic Church the only thing you believe in?
Angelo sighed.
Ava, I don't understand what you're asking me.
Do you believe in people? Do you believe in me?
Her voice was tired. She really wasn't trying to fight. Not anymore. Fighting with Angelo was like kicking a wall. She only ended up hurting herself.
I put my faith in God, not people,
he said softly, stubbornly, and Ava wanted to slap him.
But God works through people, doesn't he?
Ava insisted. He didn't answer, but waited for her to continue, looking between her face and the road they walked along, the lengthening shadows giving them a sense of privacy. He hadn't even pulled his arm away, and Ava let herself cling to it.
My father used to believe in Italy. Uncle Augusto even believed in fascism. Fabia believes in the Pope. Santino believes in hard work, and you believe in the Church. Do you know what I believe in, Angelo? I believe in my family. I believe in my father. I believe in Santino and Fabia. And I believe in you. The people I love most in the world. Love is the only thing I believe in.
Don't cry, Ava. Please.
Angelo whispered, and his voice broke in distress. Ava hadn't even realized she was. She raised a hand to her face and wiped at the moisture that clung to her cheeks.
These laws are going to destroy all of us, Angelo. It's only going to get worse. I believe that, too.
1939.
29 June, 1939. Confession. I've never hated anyone before. Not a single soul. But I'm learning. There are more racial laws.
Angelo raced home when he heard, only to find us completely unaware of what had transpired. He became the bearer of bad news.
There is never good news anymore, it seems. Jews can no longer practice their trade among non-Jews. Doctors, lawyers, journalists, all the trained professions. In one day, they lost their livelihoods. And that isn't all. We are banned from popular resorts and vacation spots. We can't spend our holidays at the beaches, the mountains, and the spas. We can't put advertisements or death notices in the newspapers. We can't publish books or give public lectures. We aren't even allowed to own radios. I laughed at that one and said to Angelo, "We can't own radios. What about electric razors? Babbo loves his new electric razor. Don't get too attached, Babbo. What's next? Washing machines? Telephones?" Angelo didn't laugh. Instead, he stared down at the decree in his hands.
"You can still own a telephone, but your names will no longer be listed in the telephone directories, and you are barred entrance from certain public buildings."
No one had laughed after that. The absurdity of it all was the most insulting part, and the insults never seemed to end. Eva Rosselli. Chapter 3. Vienna.
"My father won't leave his apartment. He says the last time he did, a German soldier made him scrub the sidewalk. The bleach burned his hands, and he can't play his violin."
Uncle Felix threw himself onto the sofa and buried his face in his hands.
"They stormed his house and took his art, his valuables. He is living in my old bedroom with nothing but his violin, which he is lucky to have. And he is worried that he can't play because of the sores on his hands. There is a German commandant living in his apartment, sleeping in his bed, eating off his plates and sitting at his table. But he still thinks he will be able to wait it out. He still thinks it will all blow over. Many of his friends have already been arrested. Musicians, artists, writers, academics, taken to a work camp. How long will they last, Camillo?" Felix wailed the question from behind his hands. Eva's father just shook his head. Uncle Felix didn't really need him to give any estimation on the life expectancy of the imprisoned Austrian artisans. They both knew. "Every day they are arresting Jews. I have to go get him. I have to get him out of Austria. I have to bring him here." "Felix, you can't," Camillo reasoned gently. "They are deporting Jews from Austria, not letting more come in. If you are lucky, you will be turned away at the checkpoint. If you are not, you will be detained and deported. There is no scenario where you will reach Otto and be able to get him out."
"I am doing all I can."
"Otto has to apply for a visa, though. He must wait in line like all the others and show them his passport. He must tell them he has family and a place to stay here in Italy."
Camillo had been over this time and again with his aging father-in-law, but Otto Adler was weary and stubborn, and the incredibly long lines outside the emigration office were intimidating. Many waiting in line were often subjected to the kind of indignities that he had suffered recently, scrubbing paint from a wall or political slogans from a sidewalk, or licking the cobblestones, or picking up horse dung with their bare hands.
"I have told him, but he won't listen," Felix mourned.
On March 12, 1938, Austria had welcomed Hitler with open arms. Anschluss, they called it. Union. But Otto Adler said the word was just Nazi propaganda to reframe a forced incorporation of Austria into Nazi Germany. Otto Adler had watched it all from his apartment high above the street. A street that was thick with thousands of people waving the crooked cross, raising their arms and calling out to the motorcade that moved slowly down the street. It was a military parade, with Adolf Hitler himself standing in an open command car, waving and acknowledging the jubilant crowds that were welcoming him, the Austrian-born conqueror, into their beautiful city. It was like nothing Otto Adler had ever seen before. A parade, but more than that. The cheering crowds treated Hitler like a savior or messiah. Otto was not impressed, and he refused to be part of the celebration. He turned his back on the parade, resuming his practice. But the onlookers were as thick as flies, and the sound from the street seeped through the windows and the walls, making it impossible for him to drown them out. Even with Tchaikovsky's violin concerto in D major singing from his strings.
Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil!
They intoned, throwing off his rhythm and making him curse. He shrugged and changed his tempo to keep time with the chanting. He was good at adapting.
That is the problem with so many Jews, he told his son in a letter. They don't adapt. They haven't assimilated. But I have. I have been welcomed into the arms of the highest society. I have played for royalty and dined with dignitaries. I am not afraid of the little Führer. I will adapt, and as long as I have my music, I am happy. I don't need much.
Still, he hated to see Austria bow to the Germans. All of Austria lay prostrate, letting Hitler roll right over them with his tanks and fiery words. And they celebrated the invasion. 8 months later, and mere days before the racial laws were passed in Italy, Nazi stormtroopers and Hitler Youth implemented and carried out violent pogroms against the Jews. In cities throughout Austria and Germany, rioters looted and vandalized Jewish businesses and homes. They burned 900 synagogues and damaged or destroyed 7,000 Jewish businesses. Instigators attacked, spit on, and threw Jewish men and women into the streets, killing 91 of them. Police rounded up, arrested, and sent 30,000 Jewish men to concentration camps. And when it was all over, the Nazis presented the Jewish community with a bill for the damages, claiming they had caused it to happen. All this terror had a beautiful name, Kristallnacht. The Night of Broken Glass. Otto Adler wrote to Camillo and told him he could have made a fortune. Ostrica would have had business for a year just replacing the smashed windows and the shattered glass in the streets. Then he'd confessed and told Felix he was finally afraid. He wasn't adapting anymore.
How can you compromise with people who don't want you to exist? They want us to disappear. I can't adapt to death.
1938 had been a very bad year to be Jewish. 1939 was even worse. Angelo went home from the seminary that day, expecting to accompany Camillo, Felix, and his grandparents to Ava's concert, only to find that she'd been asked to resign her position and leave the orchestra. No explanation. Just dismissal. She hadn't really needed an explanation. The reason was obvious. Another member was dismissed as well. The Jewish cello player she'd dated off and on the year before.
I don't care. It's their loss,
Ava said defiantly. Her chin was high and her eyes were bright. She obviously did care. But Felix cared even more. The news was yet another very personal blow to the teacher who had spent years molding her into a classical violinist. Felix wasn't adjusting well to any of the laws. He'd been in Italy for 13 years and had become a citizen after 5. But his citizenship was revoked with the new laws. Camillo had managed to get him an exemption. Angelo didn't know how, but he knew it usually had to do with money and bribes, which Camillo had gladly paid. For the time being, Felix was safe, though his father was not. His father's precarious fate in Austria and the continual insult of the Italian racial laws had made the handsome 45-year-old Austrian look 60. His blue eyes were heavily shadowed, and his light brown hair had turned almost completely gray. He was gaunt and quiet, and spent far too much time in his room.
I was the best they had, by far,
Ava said again, her eyes on her Uncle Felix.
I don't need an orchestra to be a violinist.
You are already a violinist. No one can take that from you, Felix said stiffly. But his posture belied his words. Eva watched her uncle retreat with helpless anguish written all over her face, and Angelo had to bite his inner cheek to keep himself from cursing out loud, condemning the outrageous laws and the constant strain on the family he loved. "Let's go, Eva," he said suddenly. "Let's walk. You need air, and I need gelato." He didn't need gelato. He needed to kick someone, to throw rocks through windows, something. He thought about the shop he'd seen along the main piazza the previous week. It was an apothecary shop, one he'd frequented before. They sold a salve that soothed the ache and protected the stump of his right leg from being overchafed when he wore his clumsy prosthetic. It was painted a cheery, welcoming yellow. But it didn't welcome everyone. A sign in the window said, "No Jews allowed." And next door, another shop upped the ante. "No Jews and dogs allowed," as if the two were synonymous. Angelo had swallowed back the bile rising in his throat and opened the door. A tinkling of bells alerted the shopkeeper of his entrance.
"Buongiorno, signore,"
a woman had called out from behind a row of shelves. Angelo hadn't answered, but retrieved the salve he liked from its usual spot and set it on the counter, waiting for the woman to ring him up. She had eyed him warily, his failure to reply to her friendly good morning apparently noted.
"How can you tell?"
he had asked, unable to help himself.
"Scusami."
"How can you tell whether or not someone is a Jew? Your sign says no Jews allowed."
The shopkeeper blushed and her gaze slid sideways.
"I can't, and I don't care. I also don't ask."
"Then why the sign?"
"There is a certain amount of pressure, you know. The fascisti leave us alone if the sign is on the door. I'm just trying to protect my shop."
"I see. And the shop down the street. Do the fascisti have something against dogs, too?"
She snickered as if he were making a joke, but her smile faltered as he glowered down at her.
"I have shopped here for years, but I won't be back unless that sign is taken down," he said softly. "But you are not a Jew, signore," she protested.
His black seminarian robes and broad hat made that clear.
"No, and I am not a dog, nor am I a fascist pig."
He left the salve on the counter and turned to leave the shop.
"It's not that simple, signore,"
she had called after him, and he'd glanced back at her crimson face. He had embarrassed her. Good.
"It is exactly that simple, signora," he said.
And it was. With all his heart, he believed it was. Black and white, right and wrong.
"I need to be back before sundown. It is Shabbat,"
Eva said quietly, pulling Angelo back to the present. But she grabbed her hat and gloves with an eagerness that betrayed her own need to escape for a while. They meandered purposefully, stopping to purchase their favorite gelato in huge portions, determined to forget the world around them for a moment, needing to laugh, needing to forget, needing to pretend that their lives were sweet and simple, if only for an hour or two. But they would have had to walk with their eyes closed. The world was not sweet or simple anymore. The proof of it was all around them, and neither of them was blind.
"We don't look like that, do we?"
Eva said around a spoonful of ice cream, staring down at the weekly paper someone had left behind near the park bench where they sat to eat their treat. She slid her foot over the pages to keep it from flapping in the breeze. A cartoon labeled Race Defilers, depicting a Jewish man with exaggerated features carrying an unconscious Aryan female into his private office, was front and center. Eva picked it up and studied the cartoon thoughtfully. Then she looked up at Angelo and squinted her eyes.
That looks more like your nose than mine.
She was trying to laugh it off, her voice light and purposely unaffected.
I have a Roman nose.
Angelo tried to laugh too, but his stomach churned. He'd seen too much of that kind of mockery and humor in the Italian press. It had been an ongoing campaign, worsening with the scientific manifestos on race, and the blame for all the country's problems that was constantly focused on the Italian Jews, who made up less than 1% of the country's population. Angelo read all the national newspapers, a habit he'd cultivated when he felt homesick for America. If he was to be an Italian, he had to understand Italy. And he'd tried. But even as a 12-year-old boy, painstakingly reading the politically charged La Stampa, he wondered if the papers represented Italy or just the government.
"He looks a little like Mussolini," Angelo said, wishing he could make Ava laugh like she used to.
"Yes, Mussolini and Signore Balbo, who conducts the orchestra," Ava added dryly.
And Angelo crumpled the piece of newsprint in his hand. He thought about the picture he'd seen in a newspaper of an Austrian woman sitting on a bench that said, "Nur für Arier," for Aryans only. And he wondered how long it would be before Ava was not allowed to even sit on a bench in her own country.
"You never used to observe Shabbat," Angelo said.
Not because he cared, but because he needed to change the subject.
"Yes, I know. Funny, isn't it? I never really thought about being Jewish until I started to be persecuted for it. Babo always celebrated learning above everything else, but we decided we'd better see what all the fuss is about. We're becoming devout."
She winked at Angelo and shrugged. She had grown up in the last year. She still kept a few men on a string, but the string was getting longer, the dates fewer and further between. When she wasn't teaching violin lessons to Jewish children for little or no money, she was at home, practicing. Her life had narrowed dramatically to her music, her family, and a few Jewish friends who were as watchful and reticent as the Rossellis had become.
"And what have you learned?"
he asked, sounding like Father Sebastian. He smirked to soften the effect.
"A great deal. But I haven't learned the most important thing."
"No? And what would that be?"
he asked.
"Why do people hate us so much?"
"They've taken my father," Felix cried. "He's been arrested." "How do you know?"
Camillo asked, his face pale, his hands extended toward Felix. Felix held up the letter. His hand was trembling like he was stricken with a disease, the paper flapping like he was shaking the terrible truth from it.
"Smaid, it is illegal for her to work for a Jew, but the German commander living in my father's apartment needed a housekeeper, so he hired her to cook and clean for him. She cared about my father, and I think she's watched out for him as best she could. She said she would have called me, but she was nervous about speaking freely. There are always listening ears on the phone lines. But she thought I should know. When she arrived at the apartment on the 14th, 2 weeks ago, my father was gone. When she asked the commandant where he was, he told her it was his turn."
"Where have they taken him?"
Camillo pressed. "She doesn't know for certain. She writes that the whole building was cleared. There are no Jews left. The officer told her soon there would be no more Jews in Vienna."
"I read that some of them are just being relocated to Jewish ghettos."
Camillo started pacing, trying to remain positive, his thoughts scrambling for solutions.
"The maid thinks he will be sent to a work camp. Her brother works at the train station, and he told her that every day the train leaves early, before the sun rises, so the people of Vienna won't see them leave. He says they are loaded with Jews. He says the trains have been going to a place called Mauthausen, near Linz."
"But Linz is not too far from Vienna. This is good."
"This is not good, Camillo.
None of this is good. He will die.
The certainty in Felix Adler's voice made Eva wince and Camilla collapse onto a chair. He looked completely defeated.
They wouldn't let him bring his violin. The German officer was looking at it when the maid arrived for work. He told her he's going to send it to his son in Berlin. He's going to send my father's violin to his son,
Felix repeated, suddenly enraged, and he swept his arm across the table, upending the lamp and the radio they weren't supposed to own.
What are you playing, Eva?
Felix Adler sighed from the window overlooking the garden.
I don't recognize that. It sounds a little like Chopin, but it's not. It's Chopin mixed with Rosselli, sprinkled with Adler, and doused with anger.
Eva murmured, her eyes closed, her chin gripping her violin. She expected him to scold her, to tell her to play what is written, but he was silent. She continued playing, but she opened her eyes, watching him as she let her bow flit over the strings like a bee flirting with a flower. His hands were clasped behind his back, his feet together. It was the way he stood when he was deep in thought or when he was listening. She and Uncle Felix had had a love-hate relationship since he'd arrived in Italy in 1926, 2 years after her mother's death. She had been only 6 years old and was not prepared for the maestro that was Felix Adler. He had come to Italy with the express purpose of molding her into an Adler violinist, and he had come to Italy out of love for his sister, which he reminded Eva of frequently. It was her dying wish. He'd acquired other students, and he'd played with the Orchestra della Toscana, but his focus had been Eva. Eva had challenged him at every turn. She was willful and distracted, easily bored, and known to disappear when it was time for lessons. But she had a gift. She had a remarkable ear. And what she lacked in discipline, she made up for in musicality. She loved the violin. She loved to play. And Felix had eventually learned to forgive her for the rest, though it was forgiveness bestowed grudgingly. It had taken him a while to realize that she wasn't really reading the music he put in front of her. She was listening and copying. If she didn't understand something, she would ask Felix to show her. After a few demonstrations, she could play bar after bar from memory. Teaching her to read music had been torture for both of them. She'd hated it, he'd hated it, and they'd hated each other half the time. He made her do everything she despised and rarely let her do what she loved. Long notes and scales and sight reading, day after day.
I don't want to practice long notes. I want to play Chopin.
Eva would stomp her foot.
You can't play Chopin. I can too. Listen.
Eva immediately launched into a Chopin nocturne, complete with every variation he'd purposely played, just to test her.
You can't. You are parroting. You are not reading. You are listening to me and playing without looking at your music and seeing the music as you create it. I see the music in my head, and it doesn't look like little black dots and lines. It looks like rainbows and flying and the Alps and the Apennines. Why can't I just listen and play?
She had whined.
Because I won't always be here to demonstrate. You have to be able to read the notes and turn the notes into music, both in your head and on your instrument. You are composing, but the greatest composers can see the notes when they hear music. They don't see the Apennines. And you will never be able to record your compositions if you don't understand how to read and write music.
She had learned, eventually. But she still relied far too heavily on her ability to mimic, to embellish, to adapt. The word adapt made her think of her grandfather, who hadn't been able to adapt after all.
Uncle Felix.
Eva lowered her violin and bow, interrupting her reverie and her freestyle composition to stare at her uncle's rigid back.
Please keep playing, Eva, he said quietly. What would you like me to play, Uncle?
Play whatever you wish. Something else mixed with Rossellini and sprinkled with Adler, he said, and his shoulders began to shake. She'd never seen her uncle cry, and in the last months he'd cried twice. She didn't know what to do to comfort him. So she played. She played Chopin's Nocturne in E-flat major because it was hauntingly beautiful. But she drifted off into her own arrangement and ended up playing something that didn't sound like anything she'd ever played before. When Eva finally lowered her violin, Felix had sunk into a chair and dried his eyes on a handkerchief he still held wadded up in his hand. He met her gaze, and his eyes were so sad her heart ached in her chest. But he smiled at her with tenderness and began to speak. His voice was tired, his words measured.
In my life, I've only been good at one thing, the violin. Not as good as my father. Maybe I could have been, but I drank too much and lost my temper too often. I came to Italy because I failed in Vienna. I came to Italy because I was in love with a woman who wasn't in love with me. And for the last 13 years, I've taken it out on you. If you hadn't been so strong, I might have broken you. I might have made you hate me. But you fought back. You shrugged me off. And now I listen to you and I am in awe.
You are? Eva asked in amazement. These were things she had never heard before.
When you play, Eva, I feel hopeful. They can take our homes, our possessions, our families, our lives. They can drive us out like they've driven us out before. They can humiliate us and dehumanize us, but they cannot take our thoughts. They cannot take our talents. They cannot take our knowledge or our memories or our minds. In music, there is no bondage. Music is a door, and the soul escapes through the melody, even if it's only for a few minutes. And everyone who listens is freed. Everyone who listens is elevated. When you play, I hear my life lifting off your strings. I hear the long notes and the scales, the tears and the hours. I hear you and me together in this room. I hear my father and the things he taught me that I passed on to you. I hear it all, and my life plays on, his life plays on, over and over, when you play. Eva set her instrument down, and with tears streaming down her face, knelt in front of her uncle and slid her arms around him, pressing her cheek to his thin chest. He embraced her gently, and they stayed in sorrowful silence, listening to the wind as it wailed a mournful strain, not so different from the one Eva had composed, wondering if the wind would be the only witness, the only whisper, when the death in Austria came for them, too.
10 August, 1939. Confession. I am 19 years old, and I've been kissed many times, but I've never been kissed like that. It felt like drowning but not needing to breathe, like falling but never hitting the ground. Even now, my hands are shaking and my heart is so swollen and fat, it feels like it's going to burst, or I'm going to burst. I want to cry. I want to laugh. I want to bury my head in my pillow and scream until I fall asleep, because maybe when I go to sleep I can relive it. I can't believe it happened, yet I think I've been waiting for it to happen for the last 7 years, ever since I conned Angelo into kissing me the first time. I've been waiting for him for so long, and for a couple of hours tonight, in a little world that was only big enough for the two of us. He was mine. I don't know if I will be able to keep him. I'm afraid when tomorrow comes, I'll be waiting for him again. Eva Rosselli.
Chapter 4. Grossetto. Angelo had been surprised when Camillo announced he was still taking the family to the beach house, considering the set of racial laws that had been passed earlier that summer. But Camillo had made the reservation before the law was passed, and he stubbornly maintained that he had been renting that particular lodge from the same family for 20 years, and he would keep on renting it for 20 more. So that August, only months before the war broke out, they all boarded the train for Grosseto, confident in Camillo's ability to make everything all right. The first few days of Angelo's planned 5-day retreat were spent sleeping, eating, playing checkers, and debating everything and nothing, simply because Camillo and Augusto enjoyed discussion, and Angelo enjoyed listening to them argue. In the last few months, they argued less, as fascism had revealed itself and Augusto had been proved wrong. But they still found points of disagreement and seemed relieved that they had. Eva walked a lot, her feet flirting with the surf, dancing in and out of the waves until she was wet and cold. She would lie on her big white towel and fall asleep in the sun until she was almost dry. Then she would repeat the process. Her porcelain skin had grown rosy and brown, making her look decidedly more Italian than Austrian. Her hair and eyes were dark, but her skin was unquestionably less olive than Angelo's was. His skin turned smoky after an hour in the sun, and within a few days he looked like he'd spent his life casting nets with the fishermen of Grosseto. Umbrella-shaped maritime pines fringed the beaches. And one afternoon, Angelo found himself stomping around in the cork oak woodlands, where aristocratic families still hunted for wild boar, losing himself in the shade and the scents and the quiet. As the shadows grew longer and his skin grew sticky with sweat, he tromped out of the woods and headed back toward the beach, eager for a quick swim in the cool, clear waters. Clouds had rolled in, and the sky was no longer the guileless blue it had been earlier in the day. Still, even with rain threatening, Angelo shrugged out of his shirt, removed his shoe and his prosthetic, and hopped through the waves until he could immerse himself in the Tyrrhenian. Before too long, Eva was treading water beside him, and they kicked and splashed and floated on their backs until distant thunder rumbled and urged them back to the shore. Rain was coming, but the air was still warm, and they toweled themselves off and let the heat dry their hair as they watched the storm move toward them. "What's that?" Eva inclined her head toward his pile of abandoned clothing and forest finds. He rarely saved anything, impatient with clutter and generally unsentimental, but he'd thought maybe his nonno would like that afternoon's discovery. "I found a quiver of black and white porcupine quills."
"Hmm. Well, I saw some spotted pink flamingos in the lagoon,"
Eva countered, her eyes on the water. She was smiling slightly, letting him in on the game.
"That's nothing. I woke a barn owl, and he dove at my head," he shot back. "And I killed a wild pig with my bare hands. I thought about bringing him back for dinner, but then I remembered pigs aren't kosher."
Eva pursed her lips, clearly trying to come up with a better story.
"Well, I found this."
She handed him a shell, still completely intact, still hinged at the back. He took it and peered inside. The interior was smooth and empty, the life inside long gone.
"No pearl?"
"No, just sand."
"But the sand can become a pearl,"
he offered, handing the shell back to her.
"The sand doesn't really become a pearl, silly. It doesn't become something else. It's just hidden. The grain of sand is still there beneath the layers of nacre."
"Nacre?"
he interrupted. It wasn't a word he'd heard before.
"The mineral substance that the oyster coats the grain of sand in."
The mention of the oyster had its same old effect, and Eva's eyes touched on his briefly before she glanced away. Another time it probably wouldn't have registered. But here they were, sitting in roughly the same spot where they'd sat 7 years before, when the skies were clear and no storms threatened.
You mean Mother of Pearl? How did you know that?
Babbo. He's a chemical engineer, Angelo. He knows the actual name of